voices crying out in the darkness of talk radio. This is PID Live. I'm Derek Gilbert.
I'm Sharon Gilbert, and we have the Frog Brothers.
Just a nickname that we tag these young men with because they remind us of characters from a movie that you might have seen. The Lost Boys. Yes, Edgar and Alan, the proprietors of a local comic shop who...
Edgar and Alan Frog.
Yes, who were out there fighting the darkness, fighting the evil, the vampires that inhabited their town because they'd read every comic book ever written about vampires.
They knew it all, and they could see things nobody else saw, and that's what these guys are like.
That's right.
And that's why we lovingly refer to them as the Frog
Yes.
Brothers. Those two were always my favorite characters in that movie.
They made the movie. They made the movie. Well, except for Grandpa at the end. It was Barnard Hughes. He was great.
Yeah.
Paul David Collins is the author of The Hidden Face of Terrorism, which was edited by his brother, Philip Darrell Collins. The two have written an excellent book called The Ascendancy of the Scientific Dictatorship. And together, they've contributed to Paranoia Magazine, MK Zine, News with Views, Biped, the official website of Darwinian Dissent, and the Conspiracy Archive, where you can find a collection of the articles they've written. And recently, Philip contributed an article to the Conspiracy Archive called Luciferianism, the Religion of Apotheosis, which is a lot of multi-syllable words.
These guys know every word in the dictionary, I'm convinced.
Paul,
their goal is to write a book with every word in it.
That's right.
In the book.
Paul, Philip, without any further ado, welcome to PID Live.
Thanks for having us. Thank you.
Now, again, we josh a little bit, but you guys cover some very serious topics and really do some wonderful research into the darker aspect of the human existence, and especially what the power elites are doing to kind of shape reality to their liking. Philip, your article started out with a very compelling sentence. Luciferianism constitutes the nucleus of the ruling class religion. Can you elaborate on that? What exactly do you mean by that?
Sure. Well, as you know, this conspiracy, we can really trace its philosophical lineage back several thousands of years, all the way back to Babylon and to Nimrod. And it's from Nimrod and from the Babylonian priesthood and the mystery religions that spread throughout Mesopotamia that we pretty much find the core belief system that has made its way all the way to contemporary times and it pretty much constitutes the belief system of the power elite today. It's this belief system that has really kept the conspiratorial tradition alive. This is one of the reasons that the conspiratorial tradition that down throughout the ages has been perpetuated in several different forms. Today, you know, we see it with power elite organs such as the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderberg group, the neoconservative faction of the power elite. Before that, it was more of a manifested itself in more religious forms amongst several different ecclesiastical authorities. It kind of found its way into Jesuitism. It was one of the primary moving beliefs of communism, of Nazism. But this belief system is what has kept the conspiratorial tradition alive. Nothing keeps a tradition alive quite so long and maintains its longevity quite as well as a religion. To give you an example, you have the Crusades. The Crusades lasted as long as they did because they were based upon religious convictions. And it's Luciferianism that really guides these people's thinking, that really guides these people in the promulgation of the different policies and ideas that they develop. It's really this that constitutes the backbone and the nucleus of every elite plan, and that is this ultimate desire for apotheosis.
And if I might just add, religion is always what gives any crusade its longevity just because it resonates in the deepest part of the human being, which is in the soul. And that's why we see today the neoconservatives the people that they're trying to grab and have as their primary constituents are the Christians. And, you know, they're really getting into the churches and into the pulpits, as a matter of fact, you know, because when you resonate in a person's soul, you know, you can get them very vigilant and zealous and get them to keep a plan alive and to keep the fire burning, so to speak.
So for people who aren't familiar with the definition of apotheosis, can you explain that?
Sure. To put it quite simply, apotheosis is becoming a god, is basically deification, the deification of the individual. And any belief system that promotes this core doctrine of deification, of the apotheosizing of man, of man's transfiguration into the divine, any belief system is essentially, at its core, Luciferian. It doesn't even have to make mention of the person of Lucifer. It doesn't have to make mention of the person that is the devil. And that's what makes Luciferianism so incredibly insidious. It's like what I've mentioned to you in the past. It's kind of a self-eviscerating belief system. That is, it empties itself of all its metaphysical contents. Lucifer, or Satan, is not a literal metaphysical personality to the Luciferians. Instead, Lucifer is a symbol. He represents the cognitive powers of man, what man has the potential to become. And God, in this belief system, which, by the way, finds its paradigmatic character in the Gnostic hypostasis myth, which is the hypostasis of the archons. God in that framework becomes a cruel, abusive, oppressive principle of superstition and binding man down from using these powers that could otherwise result in his transfiguration into the divine. And this belief system has been disseminated on the popular level under several different appellations, such as secular humanism. Secular humanism is, in fact, Luciferianism in its purest form. It relocates the ultimate moral authority within man himself, thus reiterating Protagoras's mantra that man is the measure of all things. And now that man has become the arbiter, the absolute arbiter of moral law, he thus decides good and evil for himself, is beyond good and evil, and essentially is God. And that's, of course, a slippery slope, because once you can reconceptualize good and evil according to your own self-interest and your own agendas, then pretty soon evil becomes non-existent, and whatever is most expedient for you is permissible. And that's why Luciferianism is so appealing to the power elite, because the power elite, they don't want any roadblocks. They don't want any obstacles to their power. And they literally believe that eventually, through the crusade to establish one world government, through the crusade to unite all the world's economies, all the world's political systems, and then through science itself, they will transfigure themselves into the divine. They will essentially become no longer human, but will become God.
Mm-hmm. You've explained that really, really well. And the very first time I came across the term apotheosis was back when I was singing opera in Nebraska, and it was the magic flute.
Oh,
That's the big culmination scene.
Yes.
Where it's celebrating Tamino's victory over the snake and over the Queen of the Night. And it's based on Freemasonry.
Yes, absolutely. And it's Freemasonry that has acted as one of the transmission belts for the belief system into this modern cultural milieu. Masons adhere to a mythic counterpart to the biblical account of Eden. And by the way, not every Mason, especially the lower initiates, are fully aware of the true inner doctrine. Some of them have bits and pieces, some of them have fragmentary understanding, but only the highest initiates understand, and only the highest initiates are aware of the true inner doctrine. So you have your common everyday rank and file Mason who, you know, will run charities, will do good things for the community, and they themselves are probably very good people. But behind that veil, behind the organizational confluences that keep these people just confused and in the dark, there is this inner doctrine. And it's basically a mythic counterpart to the biblical account of Eden. They believe that humanity once inhabited paradise but fell and must regain its former glory. But the Masonic paradise was not a garden. It wasn't the Garden of Eden. It was instead a unified human consciousness called the group soul or collective soul. Wilmshurst refers to it as a group soul or collective soul in The Meaning of Masonry.
That sounds like Carl Jung.
Exactly. Carl Jung had promulgated theories that were very much closely aligned with it, Carl Jung himself being something of a Gnostic. And this is all derivative, again, of Gnostic cosmology.
You were talking, Phil, about the group consciousness, the universal mind, and that's a goal, at least, of some of the belief systems that are umbrellaed under Luciferianism?
Yes, it is. And I'm very glad that Sharon brought up Carl Jung. Carl Jung was just one of many people who promulgated this idea under another appellation. Many other ideologues have done so as well. It was Hegel, George Friedrich Hegel, who of course developed a dialectical logic, and his dialectic would be redirected towards the socioeconomic realm and given socioeconomic applications by Karl Marx. He referred to it as the Weltgeist. H.G. Wells, who was a member of the Coefficients Club, a Fabian socialist, also purportedly a member of the Masonic Lodge and very much involved with several factions of the British power elite, he called it the mind of the race or racial mind. Mm-hmm. But it's this belief that there is this collective mind, this collective consciousness of humanity, and that collective consciousness constitutes God. And according to Gnostic cosmology, in the beginning we were all part of this singularity, which the definition for a singularity, the dictionary definition, is the condition of being one. And singularity inexplicably experiences this diaspora, and suddenly it splits into several different pluralities, and that's the corruption of man. That's when you and I became individuated and became our own people, and that constitutes the fall. And if you'll notice, this bears very close resemblance to Big Bang cosmology.
I was thinking that very thing.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that's hardly a coincidence, given the fact that the British Royal Society, whose all the founding members of which were Freemasons, were largely involved in the promulgation of Darwinism and its allied scientific materialistic paradigms. And Darwinism itself, Darwinism was kind of the corresponding edifying science to this belief in man's incremental migration towards apotheosis. But initially, the emergent deity of man, which they spell with a capital M to connote man's innate deity, is being sculpted by the golem of nature. And by the way, the golem is a Kabbalistic concept of a sentient being that was birthed by non-living matter. And you'll find that concept deeply embedded in Darwinism as abiogenesis, or spontaneous generation, which is completely a bankrupt, scientifically bankrupt theory. How you get something living from something non-living, it doesn't happen. Proven by Louis Pasteur. But at any rate, in this case, nature or the biosphere becomes the golem. Nowadays, radical environmentalist groups refer to it as Mother Earth or Gaia. And
right.
This pagan doctrine was disseminated on the popular level as metaphysical naturalism, and it holds that basically the golem of nature manages a process of evolution through natural selection, which was a concept promulgated through Charles Darwin. But at any rate, the ultimate goal of evolution is man's ascendance beyond the condition of being man. Nietzsche put it thus, thus spake Zarathustra. He said, man is something to be overcome. And that's the basic premise of evolution, that man will evolve beyond being man and will reach this post-human condition where he will cease being man altogether, but being God. And this was the ultimate purpose, ultimately, of even the ancient mystery religions. Wilmshurst says as much in The Meaning of Masonry on page 47. It was the ultimate goal of the Gnostics. It remains the ultimate goal today. It's even now ever present in the contemporary scientific culture.
We see it in the movie 2001. In fact, the music that everybody knows from that movie is Also Sprach Zarathustra.
Absolutely.
Zarathustra.
Absolutely. And if you'll notice in 2001, A Space Odyssey, that film reflects entirely the paradigmatic character of the Gnostic hypostasis myth and ultimately Luciferianism itself. The film ends with one of the central characters at the very end. He observes himself from outside of finitude. He becomes this star child, and he observes himself progressing from his present age to old age, and then into immortality. And in the sequel to that, 2010, moon of Jupiter explodes and becomes a sun, and they name that sun Lucifer.
Yeah. We're discussing Luciferianism, the religion of the ruling elites, with Paul David Collins and Philip Darrell Collins. And you brought up Darwinist theory and Darwinism a few minutes ago, and I want to expand on that just a little bit. It seems like today you can't make a career in science if you don't buy into Darwinism. Was that by accident?
No, not at all. Darwin's ascendance to prominence was engineered largely by the Masonic British Royal Society, and his chief apologist was a Freemason by the name of T.H. Huxley. And these people managed to pretty much ram Darwin and his theory down the throats of the late 19th century and well into the 20th century. And Darwinism's theory has appealed to so many, especially in the field of biology, because particularly the doctrine of natural selection seems to tie up things so nice and neat. You can just pretty much appropriate every sort of adaptation that humanity has allegedly had during this purported evolutionary process to survival of the fittest. But of course, that concept doesn't account for several things. It doesn't account for instance, humanity's love of art, of literature, of music, because these things within the world of nature, within this blood-stained struggle for survival, have no purpose.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, it was pushed home through the academic institutions, thanks to the efforts of humanists like Dewey and others, and it became pretty much enshrined in academia throughout the 20th century. It now, only now, seems to be waning in dominance with people.
If anybody wanted to know that this was coming, all they had to do was turn it to the book The Open Conspiracy, which H.G. Wells had written. And in that book, he had a chapter entitled The Need for a Restatement of Religion. I believe it was chapter 3. And in that chapter, Wells lays out what he calls a, quote, modern Bible scheme, unquote. And according to that scheme, the book of Genesis would be replaced with his book, The Outline of History. And then a Christian cosmogony, and cosmogony is simply, for the layman, it's an account of the universe, its beginnings and its development. But the Christian cosmogony would be replaced with the Darwinian doctrine that Wells had learned from none other than Thomas Huxley, the man that is known as Darwin's bulldog. And so you look at what has happened with the Bibles and study of the Bible, even from a historical perspective or from a literary perspective, being removed from the classroom, and Darwinism being taught in science, and even in those areas and aspects of science where evolution doesn't even really apply, they make sure to get it in there. And you realize, you know, that wasn't by accident that Wells had developed this a long time ago in his book, The Open Conspiracy, during a time when people still weren't really that receptive to the idea, and they certainly weren't receptive to it here in the United States.
Yeah, Wells was writing in the period of time prior to the Scopes monkey trial.
That's correct. That's correct. And yeah. Another reason that Darwinism, to account for its prominence throughout the 20th century, was with the 20th century, we saw the explosion. Not that there hadn't been preceding instances, but just an explosion of socio-political utopianism, largely bodied forth through the likes of communism, through fascism, through the various different permutations of socialism. And Darwinism provided the scientific foundation for socio-political utopianism. It pretty much gave edifying legitimacy to the mandate for immanentizing the eschaton on this ontological plane, or essentially, for all practical purposes, establishing heaven on earth, because it reduced all interest in all of humanity to a this worldly plane being, and thus gave a sense of immediacy to the plan for bringing about heaven here on earth. And it also helped edify the contentions of the transnationalist, who is basically the globalist who pushes for kind of a corporate Marxism, because in the corporate Marxist world, it's survival of the fittest by who can do the best business, and everybody else is out of the marketplace.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of a weird dichotomy there. I mean, Darwinism believes in survival of the fittest. Nature selects the most viable organisms to survive. And these Luciferians then use that doctrine to justify helping the process along by eliminating the weaker members of society, don't they?
Absolutely. That's absolutely correct, because that's where eugenics sprouts from. And if you look at Malachi Martin, in his book, not Windswept House, but the one that came before it,
Keys of This Blood.
Yeah, Keys of This Blood. He explains that the elite that we're speaking about and that were involved in Luciferianism, he describes them as being socio-political Darwinians. And it gave the global elite an excuse to basically get rid of anybody that was standing in their way in the name of helping natural selection along, and basically pushing man towards this goal of reaching a singularity, as Wilmhurst referred to it, of getting back to that beginning, to that better time, so to speak.
How are we seeing this Luciferian doctrine guiding the actions of the neocons, or are we?
Well, essentially, you'll see, for instance, with George Bush, he pretty much pushes himself off as being a fundamentalist Christian, an evangelical Christian, and who knows, maybe he actually believes that he is, but this notion of the world democratic revolution, that's not his. That is actually a concept that is derivative of the revolutionary Jacobins from revolutionary France. And the Jacobins, of course, were something of a philosophical offshoot of the Illuminati. And basically their plans was to establish what was tantamount to a scientific dictatorship in France. But if you listen to some of George Bush's speeches, he even uses the term, quote unquote, fire in the minds of men. And this was a term coined by Fyodor Dostoevsky to describe the revolutionary faith that had Prometheus as its main archetype. It came from one of the characters in Dostoevsky's stories saying the fire is not on the rooftops, but in the minds of men. And this revolutionary faith held that plebiscitary democracy was synonymous with freedom. And for the listeners out there, plebiscitary democracy is a lot different from representative democracy. Our republic, our constitutional republican system, is a representative democracy, but that is that we have representatives that represent our interests. Plebiscitary democracy, on the other hand, could be characterized as majoritarianism, which is basically majority rules, and that disintegrates into a tyranny of the majority, which can be characterized as a mobocracy. And that's essentially what did happen in revolutionary France, was the plebiscitary democracy folded, and you had the ensuing chaos, and then the rise of Napoleon thereafter. But this crusade of the neoconservatives to establish a global global democratic kingdom of sorts, and this global democratic revolution is a Jacobin concept.
So let's move back to the singularity.
Yes,
if it's a one-world government.
Yeah, because they are essentially neo-Jacobins. They're basically the new Jacobins, or Jacobins, if you will. And the Jacobins were, of course, basically adherents to that Promethean faith, and Prometheus really is just another pagan name for Lucifer. If you look
right.
If you look at the story of Prometheus and what he did in the story and how he brought fire to man, and he's punished by Zeus for doing so, it's just a paganized version of what Lucifer supposedly did. It's the whole idea of Lucifer trying to liberate man, and a cruel, jealous, vindictive god, Jehovah Adonai, punishing him for trying to free man from ignorance.
Yeah.
So that's basically how the neocons get back to this whole Luciferian idea. It's a little bit more sophisticated and harder to follow because they have this nominal kind of Christian veneer over top of them. But when you begin to dissect, in particular, what the president says in his speeches, like what Phil was talking about, when he uses terms such as the global democratic revolution and fire in the minds of men, you start to see that it does, in fact, go back to Luciferianism, and that not all, and that some Luciferians disguise themselves by wearing a cross or carrying a Bible.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And if I may add, again, this is not to say that every neocon might actually be a conscious Luciferian. René Guénon, in his book, The Reign of Quantity, which is an excellent critique on scientism, but in this book he discusses what's known as unconscious Satanism. And unconscious Satanists are basically people who believe themselves to be God-fearing moral people, but in principle they in every way reflect the adversary. And in this sense, the neocons in every way reflects the values of the adversary himself. They reflect that conceit of rebuilding Eden, returning to paradise, remaking Eden without God. Reflect the conceit that man's own cognitive powers will bring about progress towards order. And essentially, really, if you look at neoconservative theology, if you could call it that, it really reflects the paradigmatic character of Gnosticism.
You know, I would argue that the neocons are just another verse of the same song, because if you look at the symbols just on the back of our dollar bill, it's really clear that we are trying to move, or someone's trying to move us toward a unity. I mean, a pluribus unum. I mean, one out of many.
Well, you're correct there, and you're correct on pointing to the symbols on the dollar bill, because Roosevelt was responsible for having those placed on our currency, and the favorite president of the neoconservatives is Roosevelt. They were considered, the early neoconservatives were considered to be Roosevelt Republicans and New Deal Republicans, and they basically praised Roosevelt for the different socialist mechanisms that he installed during his time in the White House.
And an interesting little correlative to the New Deal and to the Roosevelt presidency was a movement known as the technocratic movement. And this movement figures in very heavily today with the neoconservative faction of the elite. The technocratic movement was an outgrowth kind of Bellamy's progressivism, and the technocratic movement basically believed in a ruling government by a coterie of experts. But one of their symbols was called the monad, and that's spelled M-O-N-A-D. And it's derived from the Pythagorean monad, but basically the way they represented it was a black and gray yin and yang symbol, and the yin and yang symbol is a motif, a common pagan motif for the evolution of humanity. It represents the conflicting forces that are bringing about man's evolution towards the divine. And it also means, I believe in the original Greek, it means one, which of course harkens back to this concept of a singularity, of being one.
Hmm.
But H.G. Wells wrote in The Shape of Things to Come, which predicted events with some uncanny precision, including World War II. He talks extensively about the technocratic movement, and says that the technocrats would be successful where the Freemasonic Lodge had failed. And I believe, now of course this is speculative, but I believe that when he says that, he's referring to the operative Masons before they became speculative Masons.
And Philip, you were just talking about H.G. Wells and how his writing predicted the spread of the technocracy through the middle part of the 20th century.
Absolutely. Well, he saw the technocratic movement being successful. He kind of takes some jabs at Freemasonry because he says that Freemasonry was incapable of garnering the political capital that the technocratic movement garnered. And I assume that when he makes these jabs at Freemasonry, if he was in fact a Mason, which there's been debate over whether or not he was, I think there's a strong case for him being a Freemason. But I think that when he speaks so derisively of Masonry, he's speaking of the operative Masons before they became speculative Masons. But technocratic movement, to give you a little bit of background on a little bit more of background on their symbol, the monad, which was a vermilion and French gray yin and yang symbol. It was in ancient culture. It was emblematic of the hermaphroditic god Brahma, which eventually divided itself into Varaj and Vak. And through the sexual union of these two deities, all things, according to that myth, gradually evolved. And of course, this evolutionary theology was disseminated on the popular level, largely through the efforts of the British Royal Society, using Darwin as their key theoretician. But at any rate, the technocratic movement experienced a great deal of growth under the Roosevelt presidency. Roosevelt fell out of favor with them because he just wasn't authoritarian enough. But what the technocrats, their vision for society was a society that was run completely by engineers and scientists, much along the same lines as the description of the world government in Carol Quigley's Tragedy and Hope, is this democracy of expertise. If I'm not mistaken, Quigley says, and I'm quoting him now, quote, "The experts will replace the democratic voter in control of the political system," unquote. But according to Frank Fisher in his excellent book, Politics of Expertise, which covers the rise of the technocratic movement, technocracy after the 70s and largely into the 80s was heralded under the appellation of post-industrialism. And in the book The Changing Images of Man, Harman, who kind of acted as the precursor to Marilyn Ferguson, calls for the creation of the post-industrial man. And of course, out of his book would come the Aquarian Conspiracy, which would act as the galvanizing tract for the 60s counterculture. And so you have this rise of the post-industrial civilization, kind of like a dismantling of our vital infrastructure to get back to being friendly with Mother Earth, so to speak, to be environmentally sound. But at the same time, this coterie of ruling elites and experts gathering up the technology and monopolizing it for themselves and pretty much controlling the political system.
We were talking about the post-industrial man, mm-hmm. and where that leads, the Aquarian Conspiracy. It almost seems, well, contradictory that this technological dictatorship, the scientific dictatorship, would lead to this I don't know, what it almost strikes me as like a flower power kind of movement.
Absolutely. If you look at what they're doing, it's more along the lines of technological apartheid. It's the reserving of the necessary technology for those who are deemed fittest to survive, while at the same time denying it to the segments of the population that they would consider dysgenic, and thus facilitating natural selection and the evolutionary development of man by getting rid of those nasty, under-evolved critters out there.
Well, it almost sounds like Brave New World, which, oddly enough, of course, was written by T.H. Huxley's grandson, Aldous Huxley.
That's correct. What Huxley was trying to capture in that book was the same thing, from a dystopian point of view, was the same thing that other writers were trying to capture from a utopian standpoint, this idea of man basically brought into a technocracy that would be classified as one writer, Charles Strauss, called it, a panopticon singularity, where the carceral state that philosophers such as Foucault spoke of has been perfected. See, Foucault, in his writings, he spoke about a carceral state that this kind of technocratic, kind of authoritarian society that was kept in line and where people were conditioned and roboticized through the social sciences. However, in today's world, with the technology firmly in the hands of the elite, thanks to technological apartheid, we have all these different kind of tools of surveillance. We have Echelon, we have Carnivore, we have the Promise software that was stolen from Bill Hamilton, and he's been fighting a 20-plus-year legal battle to get it back, but it's been modified to the point that the Orwellian implications are unbelievable. We have all of these technological tools that far exceed anything that the social scientists could have ever dreamed of, that turns this technocracy that we have rising into a technocracy where it's not only improbable to break the law or to be a dissenter. It is not only improbable, it is impossible to do so, because every move is watched, every thought is known. If it's really interesting, if you look at just recently the domestic spying scandal that we have here in the United States, the president chose to have the NSA spy on hundreds, if not thousands, of people without even going to a FISA court to try to get a warrant, even though it was very likely that they would have gotten one. The FISA courts rarely ever turn down a request.
I'd like to, shift the topic just a little bit to transhumanism, where science may take us in the future, and why we're moving in this direction. Can you tell us a little bit, what is the transhumanist movement, and why are some pretty prominent scientists getting behind it?
Sure. Well, transhumanism is, in essence, transhumanism represents a new incarnation of Gnosticism. Gnosticism is a distortion of Christian theology and Platonism. Like Christianity and Platonism, Gnosticism emphasizes the division between the corporeal and the incorporeal, or the spiritual and the material. However, the distortion begins with Gnosticism's contention that the temporal spatial realm is tantamount to a hell where the spirit is confined by the demonic agents of time and space, and the only way to overcome these demonic agents, according to Gnosticism, is to achieve gnosis, which is knowledge, and alter humanity's sensate being. In so doing, the Gnostic believes that he or she can immanentize the eschaton and establish heaven on earth. This was the aspiration of both the Nazis and the communists, and it's also the dream of transhumanism. And transhumanism, the term was actually coined by Julian Huxley, who was a brother of Aldous Huxley and a eugenicist, one of the founding forces of UNESCO, which pushed for the popularization of eugenics. He meant his context for the use of the term transhumanism was slightly different from the meaning that it's taken on now. A transhumanist ideologue by the name of Max Moore, who's also founded a philosophy known as extropianism, redefined transhumanism in its newest incarnation, and that is the transformation of man beyond his humanity into a post-human condition. It contends that our humanity is merely a consequence of time and place. Bart Kosko, a professor of electrical engineering at the University of Southern California, espoused the core precept of transhumanism doctrine when he said, and I'm quoting him now, quote, "Biology is not destiny. It was just nature's first quick and dirty way to compute with meat. Chips are destiny," unquote. So in this transhumanist context, our biological condition as humans is analogous to hell, and technology is an instrument for immanentizing the eschaton. It's the newest incarnation of Gnosticism. Transhumanism's characteristic Gnosticism probably owes its existence to the movement's Darwinian premises, because Darwinism is, in essence, a Gnostic myth. It's predicated upon the metaphysical claim that living things created themselves, which is encapsulated within the thesis of abiogenesis. This metaphysical claim provides the foundation for the Gnostic doctrines of self-salvation and self-deliverance. But it's become a sizable movement now today, one that's pushed by several scientists and several movers and shakers in the scientific community, not the least of which being William Sims Bainbridge, who is also associated with the National Science Foundation, which anybody who's, of course, tried to write away to the National Science Foundation for a grant knows how difficult it is to attain financial assistance from the foundation, but mm-hmm. because it's just such a prominent and popular organ of research and scientific development. But it has an annual budget of about $5.5 billion, and it,
billion with a B, that's a lot.
Yeah, and it provides about approximately 20% of all federally supported basic research conducted by America's colleges and universities. So these guys are major movers and shakers, and you will find within their movement and within their doctrines the a somewhat diffused version of the inner Luciferian doctrine that is held by the ruling elites.
So Darwinism was their first means of guiding and shaping the way we think by directing scientific inquiry along the lines of believing that living matter, it just created itself. And now transhumanism, am I understanding correctly that transhumanism is sort of taking it the next step, that we are about to effect our own apotheosis through the use of technology?
That's a very good way of putting it, Derek. In fact, that's exactly the way that it's headed. This is kind of like the next stage of development in this ideational continuum. One of the major means of doing this is through technology. The technology, of course, being derived from the word techne, which means craft, or this, to craft something is to shape something. Hence, this is why you'll hear, for instance, when somebody's commenting on a carpenter's craftsmanship, he exhibits exceptional craftsmanship because what he has crafted is so well crafted. Likewise, technology has the ability, has the potential for crafting things. And in a Luciferian context, it constitutes another form of sorcery. In fact, Anton LaVey considered it a form of sorcery, a somewhat ineffectual form of sorcery, but a form of sorcery nonetheless. Of course, Anton LaVey was a straightforward Satanist, and he's kind of looked down upon by other Luciferians because they consider Satanism something of a heresy. But one of the forms of resculpting humanity through technological means is nanotechnology. Nanotechnology is basically humans interfacing with machines for the purpose of improving human abilities. Now, this by itself, I don't have problems with. Okay, and it obviously has its medical applications. It's obviously has its beneficial beneficial applications for humanity. I myself, for instance, before I was age one, I lost my left eye to a tumor. I had a condition known as retinal blastoma, and the nanotechnology and other biotechnologies and closely aligned cyber technologies could possibly one day promise the creation of a prosthetic eye that could probably help me see, help the blind see out of the eye that I no longer have sight with. So that is obviously a good application. However, the amazing medical breakthroughs aside, those of the scientistic stripe, and I use the word scientistic, not scientific, there's a difference, would like to use such technology to move man beyond human to something else. And this is a very anti-human belief system. It's a very anti Christian as well, because it holds that man made imago viva die, or in the image of God, is one enormous mistake, in that in fact we as creatures that direct our own evolution must move beyond that.
You know, I'm a believer in that books, television, and movies are, you know, programming us to just buy into all of this. And if you look at Star Trek, the motion picture, you see Will going into a union with V'ger, this mechanism, and then this new creature is born. And as Kirk and McCoy walk away, we just see the birth of something new.
That's right.
The next phase in our development. And then you fast forward to today's Star Trek, and you see the Borg. It's the same thing.
That's right. That's right. And you have other semiotic intimations of it. I don't know. Have either of you seen the University of Denver Merle entitled "The Digital Transformation"?
No.
Okay.
Oh, yes, I have. I've seen pictures of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, to give the audience a little description of it, you have this picture of this goddess, and she is holding her hands out, and issuing forth from her hands is the DNA double helix, the human genetic code, and it ascends into the heavens towards the stars, and becomes a series of ones and zeros. And so you have the goddess, which is a common motif within pagan religion. But there's an interesting scientific dimension to that, with the DNA ascending towards the stars and becoming ones and zeros. The helix is a conversion into binary numbers. Semiotically gesticulates towards the hypothetical concept of cyber survival, and this concept has been largely espoused by a man by the name of Ray Kurzweil, who is of course very prominent in scientific circles. He's addressed the Council on Foreign Relations on a few occasions.
Phil, telling us about the belief system that mankind might use technology to escape the bonds of humanity.
Sure. Well, in his book, The Age of Spiritual Machines, Ray Kurzweil asserts that a digital transformation, much like the one that's depicted on the University of Denver mural, could be achieved through a magnetic resonance imaging or some technique of reading and simulating the human brain's neural structure within a computer. And thus man would become a god, and the spirit of which would inhabit cyberspace and would find incarnation in the corporeal body. And it, essentially what you'd have there it would be a being that could incarnate itself within any number of physical vessels that it chose. And Ray Kurzweil, again, is not some marginalized cult leader. He's been involved in the founding and development of 9 businesses, one of which is dealing specifically with virtual reality. And this sort of thing was these sort of concepts were heralded by sci-fi writers such as Arthur C. Clarke. Of course, we were discussing 2001 earlier, which was a work by Arthur C. Clarke. Clarke discusses a digital transformation of sorts in his sci-fi novel, The City in the Stars. And a person who's closely aligned with Ray Kurzweil, a sociologist by the name of William Sims Bainbridge, who I mentioned earlier. William Sims Bainbridge discusses religious engineering, which is basically the construction of a brand new religion. And if you look at Luciferianism, that's essentially what Luciferianism is. It's the product of religious engineering. It's the reconceptualizing of traditional religious archetypes and concepts along the lines of one's own self-interest, really. But Williamson Bainbridge believes that religious engineering, guided by scientists, will lead to what he calls the Church of the God Galactic. And the Church of the God Galactic, he says, finds its proximate origins, again, with science fiction literature. And, of course, you have men like Arthur C. Clarke. And, of course, we've been discussing H.G. Wells and Aldous Huxley before him, who have figured in prominently in presaging some of this. And so it would appear that what we have now is this movement towards incarnating their visions and tangibly enacting what they had in mind, and their beliefs in turn were just derivative of older pagan ones, and now it's just they believe they have the scientific and technological tools to tangibly enact that vision.
Isn't it interesting though that these fellows, I would bet for the most part, would deny any sort of religious overtones to what they're doing?
That is absolutely, I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, do you see that in the research that you do? Do these guys doing this because they believe that they are, in fact, deity, or they do it because they don't believe in the existence of the supernatural?
What I think it is, really, for instance, William Sims Bainbridge discusses, in one of his papers, discusses secularization. And secularization, he says, it's commonly associated with atheism, the rejection of God. Yet Bainbridge makes clear in this paper that secularization is not the obliteration of religion. It is instead the clearing of the spiritual marketplace and the installation of a new religious authority. It comes as a little surprise that secularization could facilitate this shift in religious thinking, because atheism itself is a philosophical impossibility premised upon the notion that man has the omniscience and omnipotence necessary to conclusively reject God's existence. Of course, mm-hmm. Anyone who possesses omniscience and omnipotence is by definition a god. So secularization, and Bainbridge himself, being a sociologist, and sociology, the field itself having technocratic origins, and also a member of the National Science Foundation and closely aligned with the transhumanist, he himself says that secularization merely acts as a segue period for shifts in the dominant religious cultural milieu. The dominant ecclesiastical authority is gradually supplanted by a new theocratic order, which is bodied forth by an occult counterculture movement. And we're seeing now intimations of such an occult counterculture movement. I believe that transhumanism is one of its latest incarnations. You also have it with the various UFO cults. Jacques Vallée, who's has done an excellent job in examining some of those. But basically, these sort of groups step in to fill the void. And while they are ostensibly non-religious in character, there are very strong religious overtones.
This is not your father's Satanism, in other words.
Yeah, in other words, these guys are an unwitting segue.
We're talking with brothers Paul David Collins and Philip Darrell Collins. They're the authors of The Ascendancy of the Scientific Dictatorship, and we're talking about Luciferianism tonight in all its many forms. I would never have guessed, fellas, that it was as broad a scope as you have outlined here tonight. And it all comes back to from the same source. When you say Luciferianism, you think about people in black robes sacrificing things on an altar. But it's not that way, is it?
Well, not quite. Again, it's pretty diffused. And I don't want to say that. The framework of it, the belief system's framework is pretty elastic. But there's still some precepts that remain in place, and always one of the common themes within Luciferian belief systems is the theme of man becoming God. And any belief system that espouses this doctrine of apotheosis is, in essence, Luciferian. And Luciferians, like some Satanists, don't have to even acknowledge the literal existence of a metaphysical personality known as Lucifer or Satan. He can be a symbol to them, but they can adhere to the principles that he represents nonetheless. And I think for the adversary, such an adherent would be more ideal than the literal Satanist who openly worships Satan, because such an adherent is blinded and so hungry for power that they're willing to follow whatever mandates the adversary has laid out to be followed.
Mm-hmm. And now, even under this definition, then, some sects of Christianity, or even some, say, erroneous beliefs within, I guess, what you call mainline Christianity, could be considered Luciferian. I mean, for example, Dominionist theology, in which it's believed that Christians have to go forward and take dominion of the earth.
Bring heaven on earth.
is basically then a Luciferian doctrine, isn't it?
Yeah, well, lots of these different nominal Christian groups, such as the Dominionist, I believe in dominion, but in a totally different, completely different different way. Dominion is a spiritual concept, and they're
right.
Basically extrapolating it into the socio-political realm in a way that it was just not meant to be. But these nominal Christian groups are simply Gnostics that refrain from Jehovah bashing. For a lot of them, the Lord no longer performs signs or wonders or healings or miracles. And under these circumstances, the world becomes a Gnostic hell, and the physical world is nothing more than a bathhouse and a haven for sin and poverty and disease, and the spirit must be freed from all of this. And what a better way to free the spirit than by disintegrating the physical world with a nuclear holocaust? And if you'll notice, a lot of these so-called Christian groups are pushing for just that. They're hoping to get whip up some kind of war in the Middle East that will lead to a domino effect and lead to some kind of nuclear kind of holocaust, and they'll be raptured out of it all. And they believe all along that this is a Christian idea that they're adhering to, when it's a complete perversion of everything that Christianity teaches, and it actually pushes people more into the camp of the secularists or the far left that just don't want to have anything to do with anything remotely Christian.
Yes, and if I may add to that, any Christian knows that given the sovereignty of the Lord, it's not your job to accelerate his march here on earth. It's not your job to to, I mean, when the Lord has a job for you to do, he will let you know. That's what he did, with all his Old Testament saints. That's what he did mm-hmm. with the New Testament disciples. He told them, go and do this, go and teach this. But otherwise, he doesn't need some group of wackos going in and hooking mm-hmm. up some sort of detonation device to the Temple Mount and blowing that up and making the Muslims angry at the Jews and the Jews angry at the Muslims and causing some war in the Middle East. And for all they know, the war that takes place in the Holy Land could be of an entirely different nature, and it requires revelation and prayer to understand these things. Somebody's socio-political activism along those lines doesn't bring any more enlightenment.
Our phone number is 800-313-9443, and we have a caller from Kentucky. Let's bring in Danny. Danny, you're on PID Live.
Hey, Derek. Hey, Sharon. How you guys doing?
Doing fine, Danny. How are you?
Boy, I don't know. I'm trying to digest all this semantical ping pong. It seems like they have Webster's Dictionary. Boy, you guys got that memorized front to back. All these words, you know, I'm getting a swab behind my eye. The only thing that I'm trying to say, and gentlemen, forgive me. I mean, I don't mean to be a smarty pants on, but I've got to speak up on behalf of Christianity. I mean, you guys are obviously intelligent and digital transformation and all this stuff. It just takes me back to the beginning. You know, I'm very simplistic. I have a simplistic belief. Christians, so named as Antioch, and Satan is just a counterfeit. He has a grotesque caricature of a kingdom with a third of the fallen angels. Very simplistic. I want to ask Paul and Philip, as smart as you guys are, within yourself and all the studying and all the knowledge and whatnot, do you not feel something missing? I mean, are you Christians? Have you ever thought about the Lord Jesus Christ or a higher power?
Well, we both are Christians. What we do is we approach this topic from the standpoint of scholarship, so that people that are not Christians can also appreciate what it is that we're trying to say. Because what you got to understand is that the manipulation of social change that we see going on here is creating a world in which nobody will be happy. And that includes other people of the other Abrahamic faiths, both the Jews and the Muslims. They're not going to be happy either in the reality that's being shaped, and so we approach it from do in our books and in our writing, you know, do certainly let people know that we are Christians and that we come from that perspective, but we want to keep this on a scholarly level, because this is a field that already just strives for some legitimacy, because of all the junk that's out there, that's supposedly written to enlighten the population, but instead causes us all to labor under the horrible appellation of conspiracy kook. And
excuse me, I want to interject just for a moment. Am I speaking with Paul or Philip?
You're speaking with Paul.
Okay, Brother Paul, God bless you. I tell you, have you guys ever heard of genius through simplicity? I mean, you say on a scholarly level, but in the book-selling world, I mean, you guys are like so intelligent. I mean, you have to, for me, or maybe it's just me, you know, to bring it down on a level that, can't you find some simpler words to?
Working on that, you know.
I mean, I'm listening, God bless you all, but my gosh, man.
I just want to make it clear. Danny, I think you understand this, but for the other listeners, I want to make it clear. What Paul and Philip are doing is exposing Luciferianism.
It becomes confusing, Sharon. It
yeah,
adds
I,
to the, it, it takes people that I truly think it's almost a veil within itself, because if you go to the King James in the Middle English, which is translated from the Hebrew or Chaldean, what you have it, Aramaic, and the Greek, by the writers of that time, by divine inspiration, if you go right to the Word of God, it's a very simplistic thing, and it's designed that way.
It is, but you know, the
you
people that they're
harder.
Speaking to...
People make it harder, sis.
They're speaking to the scientific community
that's trying to buy into this.
Well, I come from a scientific background. This is how these people talk.
Well, I apologize. I mean, I'm just saying, my gosh.
Well, don't you notice, not to say, I'm not trying to be offensive here, but you say that, you know, it keeps it very simplistic, that the Bible keeps it very simplistic. And my favorite version of the Bible to read is the 1611 edition of the King James and all, but, it does keep it simplistic, but look at how many denominations there are out there. See, so it doesn't matter how simplistic you make something, people end up making it complex anyways.
Well,
I understand this,
but see, there is no denomination. There's only the church.
There shouldn't be any
Christ.
Denominations, but
see,
we. But
that's
if we're,
the simplicity of it. You have to understand. Men make it hard. See, you go back to the beginning, Paul, the sons of Cain, Tubal Cain. It's always the pride of life, see. Men want to say, let us do this, let us do that.
Certainly.
You know, well, we were created to serve God for his good pleasure.
Certainly.
You know, the whole of it, it's so simplistic. We're made to obey the commandments and serve God.
Okay, the principle underlying that is simplistic, yeah. I mean, it's as simple as serving the Lord.
It's genius, the simplicity.
But,
it's not designed to be all technical.
But don't belittle at the same time, try not to belittle the cognitive powers of man involved in that. Now, the Luciferians, they bowdlerized that, and they basically take the cognitive powers of man to symbolize man's innate deity, which it does not symbolize that. They are basically crudely caricaturing perverting the idea of man being made in God's image. They are now contending that man is the image of God himself. And man is made in God's image, and his cognitive powers reflect that. Because if you notice, the Lord, he is the creator. Likewise, we as humans, as reflections of him, create. And our cognitive powers are involved in that. And that's why the Lord is not calling on us to quote-unquote, dumb it down. We're, in fact, in one piece of scripture, he says, come, let us reason together. He says, he's basically inviting us to reason with him and join in him, with him in reasoning and using our minds. And
well, I think that's a great answer, and Danny, God bless you. Boy, my whole family's from Kentucky. I'm with you on many of these things, but I appreciate the Collinses for the way they approach it. We have other callers, Danny, so we're going to have to let you go for tonight. Thank you for calling us.
We appreciate that very much. Danny, let's go to line number two now, Adam in Tennessee. Adam, you're on the line with Paul and Philip Collins.
Terrific. I'm really impressed with what I'm hearing. Real breath of fresh air. I just stumbled upon a station. I don't really stay up this late, but I had to be taking a friend home. And I just am so grateful for their ability to articulate these things intelligently. In contrast to your last caller, I understand where he's coming from. I think Jesus was able to speak to miraculously to both ends of the spectrum, to the intelligentsia and to keep it simple enough for a child to understand. These guys maybe have a little ways to go, but praise God, you know, we've only got one Savior.
Yeah.
Anyhow,
he's not me.
Yeah, and that's the whole point of, I think it's incredible the way you guys are able to get a handle on the Luciferian influence. Of course, you know, I think it's 2 Corinthians 4:4, Paul, the Apostle Paul says that Satan's the god of this world. When I came out of the occult, the last thing I ever thought I'd do was give the time of day to, you know, to Jesus and the Bible. But lo and behold, here I am. I think it's the most intelligent faith around. And what amazes me is how subtle and how pervasive Luciferianism is. So that even most Christians have no concept of
that's right.
You know how pervasive it is, and so they're in unwittingly getting involved in it left and right. You know. So I think we need to articulate the faith and go deeper. You know, Jay Cimbala, from his book Fresh Wind and Fresh Fire, he reiterated that statement that Christianity in America is miles, 5 miles wide, but what the rest of the sentence is?
About 2 inches deep?
Half an inch deep, something like that, you know?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And to me, this culminated in an experience my wife and I had. We were staying at an RV park and walking around the track that we like to stay fit. Somebody all of a sudden posted one of those Ten Commandments yard signs, you know, out there by the gazebo. And I'm a preacher, so I believe in the Ten Commandments. So I thought, well, I'm going to find out who put that there, because I don't want them thinking I'm pushing my religion on people. I really believe in free choice and so forth. So we went to the park managers, and the Lord gave me the grace to phrase it this way. I wanted to just come out and say, you know, I didn't put that there, and I wanted folks to know. But I says, you know, can you tell me, do you know who put that there? She says, yeah, I did. And this is a woman that if she doesn't have a cigarette in her hand, she's got a beer. And, you know, I think we've all got some growing to do. You know, I've got my challenges. But I generally accept the idea that a Christian is going to, you know, honor their body as the temple, and that they're going to make strides. Something like drinking and smoking, I think is pretty basic, that we want to divest ourselves as soon as possible as Christians. Anyway.
How you doing?
I'm doing great. Hey, you two brothers.
Hey.
I'm really enjoying your show. Let me just throw this at you. I got some from the 1700s and 1800s, some facsimile encyclopedias and dictionaries. Let me just throw this at you. Parasite. This is from 1828. Webster's parasite, and they're saying in modern usage, which is 1828, a trencher friend, one that frequents the tables of the rich and earns his welcome by flattery, a hanger-on, a fawning flatterer. And it says in ancient Greece, a priest or minister of the gods whose office was to gather of the husbandmen the corn allotted for public sacrifices. And the parasites also superintended the sacrifices. Just wanted to share that with you.
Wow.
Interesting. Word of the day.
Yeah, if you wanted to look at elitism and the power elites today, I mean, you could pretty much characterize it as the institutionalized parasiticism.
That's right. Let's move to Mike in Kentucky. Mike, you're on with Paul and Philip Collins.
Well, sort of speaking to a previous caller there, I think as the media gets more and more, I guess, fractionalized or specialized, I think people should not be insulted if they feel like people are speaking over their head, because there's going to be more specialized shows that, you know, the media generally, traditionally for the last 50 years has been taught that they need to write their news and their analysis at something like a sixth grade level.
That's correct. Yeah.
That was Jethro. He made it to the sixth grade, you know? So, you know, don't be insulted by people that try to maybe what you see is overanalyze stuff. But, yeah, be not deceived from the simplicity. The basic premise is concept of the Savior is mm-hmm. not to be overlooked. But to say that the 1611 Bible is not something complicated for us in our modern American language to understand is also being in denial. I know I struggled very hard with Shakespeare. I mean, I could not, and that actually helped me read the Bible. But I really prefer the new revised, or the revised standard edition, which is no longer in print. It does have its downfalls, but you can go back and look at the 1611 or even the later versions that are still called King James or the New King James or whatever. But don't be insulted by media that seems to be trying to talk over your head. I think that's a little self-centered by some
God
people.
God bless you, Mike. That's a good comment.
Thank you for your call, Mike. Well, Philip, Paul, this has been a great 2 hours. It's gone very quickly. Tell us, where can people get a hold of the book, The Ascendancy of the Scientific Dictatorship?
Well, folks can get a hold of it through BarnesandNoble.com. That's all one word, BarnesandNoble.com. They also can get a hold of it through iUniverse.com. That's all one word, iUniverse.com. And through Amazon.com, basically all the dot-commers. And also, Paul and I have been currently working prodigiously on a new expanded revised edition of that book. We're not sure when we'll have it ready, but we're hoping it'll be done before February is out. And it's twice the size of that one now. So
bigger and better.
Well,
yeah.
All right. You can also go to conspiracyarchive.com. Check out all their articles there. Go to peeringintodarkness.com and see what we're up to.
Paul and Philip, thanks for being our guest tonight. We do appreciate it. And we welcome your comments at radio@peeringintodarkness.com.
And you can join us at the forum at peeringintodarkness.com/forum.